Hello and welcome to another Caper Cast. I can't find Christy. She must be in the bathroom. But I'm pretty sure this is caper number 10. And we're going to do a little something different this time. Instead of me just spinning yarns, I'm going to bring you some of the voices of the people that I've been talking about in the previous 9 issues. The audio quality may be a little distant in some of these because what I'm doing is grabbing the voices from some of the 90 hours of video that Scott Brown and I have collected for our Outrig project. For instance, you remember that story about taking Woody Brown for a sail at age 94? Well, as soon as we got him on board that day, he started telling stories, and Scott managed to capture this one before we started sailing.
I used to love to race everybody, give the tourists a thrill, you know. So there was destroyer out off Diamond Head, and we just happened to come together out there, see. So, you know, let's race with them, yeah. So we're racing with them, and I'm passing them. Are you like that? And when I pass them, I looked, all of a sudden, a big wig came out behind his boat. He poured on the coal. He wasn't about to see me going by him, you know? I went by him anyway.
So maybe you remember, we had 2 sister ships to Woody's original Manu Kai. One was the namesake, the Manu Kai owned by Phil Carr. And Woody sailed in that one, but we also had Tom Warren's sister ship called King Kamehameha. And here's Tom talking about his boat.
My name's Tom Warren, and I'm proud to be a Woody Brown owner for 30 years now. Think about it. I tell people it's like having an old Stearman or a DC-3, you know.
Yeah.
It's 1947 still.
Yeah.
Still good.
And then once we got underway, we got out into the wind, and Tom could see the gusts coming, and his boat began to move. He let out one of the most satisfying grunts that I've ever heard from a sailor. But over on Phil's boat, when they saw the gusts coming and got out into the wind, it sounded like this.
I'm going, you're all going swimming now.
I got my fins. Is this what it was like in 1947, Woody?
Well, fortunately, we did not go swimming that day, but it sounds like it wouldn't have bothered Woody at all. That's just a little of what it sounded like on that seminal sail with him when he was 94 in 2005. Now, I've told you a lot about Arthur Piver, the man who popularized the modern trimaran. He's also the multi-hull pioneer who vanished at sea in 1968. We have his voice from 1967 narrating his own film presentation. And this clip has Piver sailing in England in company with the great Sir Francis Chichester in his monohull. Piver and his crew, Rich Girling, are overhauling him in their little trimaran. This clip explains something of the schism, the antithesis that existed between the monohull and the multihull community at the time.
You're looking at the famous Gypsy Moth 4th being sailed by Sir Francis Chichester off Plymouth, England, where we overhauled her in a light breeze on our 33-foot stiletto on July 2nd, 1967. Sir Francis had been ill, but his voice sounded surprisingly vigorous as he addressed us through an electronic megaphone. His first words were, "How about a tow?" We felt pretty smug at what we are doing here, sailing a circle around the far larger boat. To Sir Francis, it undoubtedly was a calculated insult.
Well, it sure was, and that's just one example of Arthur Piver's bombast. I think it was less than a year after Joanna and I made our voyage down to Mexico in our 24-foot nugget, Piver's loyal friend Rich Girling built and finished his nugget and sailed it to Hawaii.
Rich Girling is our crewman. He had been a surfer, had never sailed, but became interested in our trimarans and built a 24-foot Nugget. The first thing we knew, he rang up and said, "The boat's finished. How do you run it, and which way is Hawaii?" He found Hawaii, and that is the kind of guy who got this movement off the ground. For the difference between this new sailing and the old sailing is far greater than the difference between monohulls and multihulls. The difference is one of attitude toward the sea. We are more surfers than sailors, and to a surfer, the sea is just a great big playground, and a big wave, and a thrill and a challenge.
Now that was true. Like me, Piver had come from a traditional seafaring background, where boats were designed and built like a fortress to defend the sailor from the sea. But by now, a lot of people had experienced scuba diving and surf riding and beach catting. And as Piver said, all of a sudden the sea became a great big playground, a completely different attitude toward the sea. And that attitude was manifest in these new lightweight seafaring vessels. And we were all caught up in this thing, but Arthur Piver was so convinced of what was coming. This film clip shows his boat sliding along on a fast reach in smooth water, and he takes the opportunity to get off a shot like this.
You can see why we know all speed records will be held by multi-hulls. We can look steadfastly in the face of centuries of sailing tradition, billions of sailors, and say, "You guys were all wrong. This is the way you should have been doing it."
Now that has got to be Arthur Piver at his bombastic best. Bless him. You know, centuries of tradition, billions of sailors, you guys were doing it all wrong. Of course, the predominance of those billions were hauling fish or carrying cargo or cannons. But Piver was a true visionary. He could see what was coming, at least as far as recreational boating was concerned. And my own, perhaps equally bombastic, opinion is that the future of this lightweight seafaring phenomenon is definitely headed toward commercial applications. But let's face it, Art, in case you're hearing this, we all stand on the shoulders of others. I certainly stood on yours, for which I am eternally grateful. Well, the next multi-hull pioneer whose voice I have handy is that of Mr. James Warham. James began his design career in the mid-1950s when he and his crew of three young women sailed his rather basic plank-built catamaran from England at least to the Canary Islands, and then returned to England by way of Barbados in a larger catamaran that they had built on the beach in Barbados. The first plans for Warham Designs were actually drawn by his original wife, Ruth, with James's oversight. And since the 1970s, most of the actual design on paperwork has been done by his lone surviving wife now, Hanukkah Boone, again with James's oversight. Hanukkah is a gifted illustrator, and she's been able to illustrate their plans and their promotional materials with wonderful pencil drawings and photographs revealing lots of fun and sun and skin. And this combination has resulted in their selling more plans to backyard builders and more completed boats by backyard builders than all the rest of us backyard designers combined. And there's another factor about Warham Designs, at least in most of the early boats. They were wonderfully seaworthy because they had high underwing clearance. That is, the bridge between the hulls was sufficiently elevated up to the sheer line of the hulls in order to keep the wave tops from pounding on the bottom of the bridge. So many catamarans, even today, lack that feature. And indeed, this phenomenon of pounding on the underwing at sea is such that, in my opinion, if you can't get through the tunnel of a catamaran in a kayak, then the wing is too low. Indeed, underwing pounding is the Achilles heel of multi-hulls, particularly catamarans. Now, Scott Brown and I were invited for the peak experience of sailing with James and Hanukkah aboard their 55-foot catamaran Spirit of Gaia through the Greek islands in 2006. And we have something like 11 hours of on-camera interviews and adventure with these people, all material that has not yet been edited, part of the Outrig project. We want to bring it to you. But for now, we have just a short clip of James's voice talking about how it was that he decided to go for what he calls a canoe-type vessel.
I would have hunted happy with a small dhow or a small junk, but I didn't have the skills to build it. As a result of Eric de Bishop's voyage and my studies of the Pacific and the logical thing, it occurred to me that with the canoe vessel, you get the maximum amount of boat with the minimum amount of materials and the minimum amount of work.
Now, maybe you've deduced that women have played a very important part in James's life, and that's true. At times, at least in his younger days, he was a roaring polygamist. But in all fairness, each of the women that he invited into his team all became equal partners in the design game. And as you might guess, at some point that caused James some difficulty. I once got a letter from him saying, "Jim, I've had a very difficult year. I was divorced by three wives at once." But when Scott and I were with them, it was down to dear Hanukkah. And at one point on the voyage, Scott decided to sort of hold her feet to the fire to get her to explain the workings of their polygamous relationship. So here's Scott's question and Hanukkah's answer.
Most people, or many people, would see this as a huge contradiction. They'd think, as soon as you'd say, one man more than one woman, they think, well,
no,
they're subservient and he's the master.
Not at all. Women together, first of all, I only had to cook once every 4 days or whatever. That made a big difference. I only had to wash up once every 4 days. I had much more time. I got just as much quality time with him as I ever wanted. He was a bit of a handful anyway. Nobody would want him single-handed. He was so it was much better to share him. And ever there was a problem, you see, you don't have this one-to-one struggle and quarrel. There was always an outsider there that could adjudicate and say, "Hey, come on, James. Jim, don't bully that girl."
Well, I think Hanukkah explains herself pretty well there. And I can see why, as she says, James would be a bit of a handful. He is one randy son of a sailor. And that approach to advertising their boat designs has been a very effective means of establishing a product personality, as the advertising agency would say. But however you look at it, the Warhams have been responsible for more people going to sea in boats that they built themselves than any other designer in our time. There are over 10,000 clients on their list. Well, let's see, who else have I spoken of in these previous capers that I might have voices for? Let me see.
Are you asking me? It's about time. I think the listeners would like to hear the voice of that guy who had the shipwreck. And if they're like me, they want to know how a guy like that can afford to spend his life building these oddball boats and sailing twice around the world. Was he born with a silver spoon in his mouth? Or did he rob banks and smuggle dope? And how do all you sailor dudes induce these women to go with you?
Well, Christy, be careful of what you're asking for. You're asking me to start talking about Mark Hassel. He's the shipwreck guy. And there's not room for that. We'll have to go on to CaperCast 11. Let's do that. But before we do, let me assure you here that he worked hard for every mile he sailed. Some of my clients and other multi-hull people did go in for contrabanding, but they found that it was hard money and with sometimes dire consequences. And after losing his first boat, actually it was his second trimaran, he had a Piver 30, but after losing his brown design in a shipwreck, a total loss. He recovered and built his 37-foot Sea Runner by producing giant slides out of fiberglass for amusement parks. And he and Bonnie sailed away from California in 1971, I guess. And we left in 72. He went west. We went south. He went west about around the world, and we went south down through the Panama Canal and up into the Caribbean, and we crossed tracks again there in Guatemala at the Rio Dulce. He sailed into the Rio Dulce. This was 3 years later, and he was broke. But he managed to build himself a very fanciful little house down there in the jungle. And the local Guatemalan people were actually, the highland people were just discovering that they had this wonderful resource down on the Rio Dulce, tropical paradise, and they commissioned him to build several houses for them. He built these rather artistic and let's call them whimsical jungle homes, and recovered financially in that manner. And I'll go on with the rest of the story, but anyway, he definitely was not born with a silver spoon in his mouth. But remember now, this was during the can-do generation. People were sufficiently confident in their jobs or their ability to get a job that they were willing to undertake these giant projects. And back then, some women were the same way. They would bump into a guy, become captivated with his dream, buy into the guy's trip. And in many cases, the first mate of the vessel became just as important as the captain, more important especially in the case of cruising families. So this concludes Capercast number 10, and we have just begun posting this week, mid-September 2016. This has been a pretty good trip so far, and with your help, it's bound to get better. Bye-bye.
Hey, folks. Have you seen the show notes for each Capercast? If not, check them out at www.outrigmedia.com. That's where you'll find notice of videos and other stuff that relate to each caper. And there is a place there for your feedback, where you can even tell him to fire me, or tell me to just let the geezer be. Okay. And thanks for hanging in for our first 10 Capercasts. Mm-hmm.